Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Ben. Join me as I chat with big thinkers, leaders, and decision makers in the world of tech. We talk about developments and big movements in the tech industry, along with stories, anecdotes, and advice for your own career. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify, or join us on Slack. Hi guys, welcome to the show. Today we're joined by Anna Hartman, who is Head of Charter Tech Business / People Manager at Flixbus. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm very, very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. It's great to have you on. To get us started, could you give us a bit of information about the service that you provide at Flixbus?
Sure. I'm pretty much leading the charter tech division of Flixbus. So everyone knows Flixbus for its traditional line business, the buses that go everywhere. You know, we're kind of painting the world green in a way with green buses. But the charter side of it is not that famous. We work with corporate clients where they'd like to rent the whole bus to go somewhere. So this is purely focused on group travel. And I am responsible for the whole division of tech division, pretty much, of developers, designers, testers, agile coaches, product owners, etc. And they're making sure that the website, the applications are running, and we can onboard our customers and provide the best service we can at the particular moment.
Excellent. I'm intrigued to find out how you got to this point in your career. Can you give us a bit of insight into kind of your career history to this date?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be happy to. I was born in 19. I'm joking. But in a nutshell, I graduated. I grew up and I kind of was developing in US. And then I moved over to Europe. I graduated from my third master's at that point at Central European University, one of my alma maters. And afterwards, I was already quite involved in the NGO sphere. I was very, very politically active and socially active. I was constantly taking part in LGBT demonstrations, human rights demonstrations, fighting for equality, especially in Eastern Europe. It's one of the best places to do that, to be honest. Sometimes fortunately, sometimes unfortunately. And I was writing a lot. So I was a journalist. Back then I was also based in Russia for some time, and I was recording what was going on there when there were lots of protests happening. I've always been curious what else is out there. So I kind of fell into a pit, which many people I think do, especially young people. I joined the corporate and I worked at one of the global corporations, AB InBev, for about, 5 or 6 years. I started as a master data specialist and then grew to supervise the whole business service division. This is where I learned a lot about program and people management, and I grew to love it very much. And this is where I first touched with tech. But it took me a while to realize that tech is not simply an application or, how the integration, the data, but tech is a culture, tech is an environment, tech is a community. Afterwards, when I moved over to Germany, I joined Flixbus, and that was kind of my third big episode where I joined the startup community, which is something quite special. And I combined tech and startup. That was also the moment when I started realizing that tech is, again, it's not just simply a tool or a community, but tech is also can be very tightly connected to a bigger cause, be it a better one, like environmental stability, for instance, or helping environmental processes, or helping those in need. And I discovered for myself this brilliant connection of tech development and helping people who need help or helping in development processes, kind of social impact, you call it, or social enterprise. Since then I've been combining it. At Flixbus, I'm leading people, I'm responsible for strategy, technical and product strategy, but in my free time, I'm doing a lot in trying to connect tech and social impact and trying to connect startups and the corporate, the gap that currently exists. And that's something that, so far is working for me and is pretty exciting.
That's an amazing story. You mentioned there that you're really interested in the social side of tech mm-hmm. and the impact that it can have in society. I mean, I find that really interesting. Have you got any more thoughts on this connection between tech and how it can impact society?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it took me a while to understand that. I think it became very, very obvious during the COVID-19 crisis, mm-hmm. how tech and social enterprise connect. But to be honest, what I realized is that tech and social enterprise and the impact, the social impact, are created kind of, they've been created for each other. They are very connected. They support each other. Because I've seen how incredible it is when techies, I call them techies, pretty much people who work in tech, started getting together. And that's been happening, like I would say, for the last maybe half a year. I've been started getting together during hackathons and any other online events and just coding and creating applications to help people. To give you an example, one of the applications which many developers at Flixbus also contributed to was to kind of help your neighbor application. So you can post there what you need to buy in a shop, and then anyone who's around in any kind of in the neighborhood can pick up the order and say, yeah, sure, I'll go in the shop, I'll get your stuff, and then I'll bring it at your door, just you can transfer the money online. And it sounds so bloody obvious and easy, but this whole crisis that happened activated it. It's like someone pressed a button. And this connection between tech and helping each other has become so incredibly obvious. It kind of went into the first front. Also, what I've seen, tech is facilitating and boosting social activity and impact as well, mm-hmm. because it's becoming a little bit easier. And funnily enough, you don't even have to be a hardcore developer sometimes. If you are in tech, if you're a designer, people manager, or product owner, and you can use the digital tools, the borders, the physical borders are being erased. So you can work with someone, if you're based in the US, you can work with someone in Bulgaria or in Malaysia, as long as there is internet connection and Wi-Fi, and you can help on developing the project on delivering water somewhere in Afghanistan. This is absolutely mind-blowing. And all you need to do is just leverage tech, because the tech borders kind of are non-existent. The more you take artificial intelligence, right, take any other algorithms that the guy are developing, it's pretty much limitless as long as you understand what problem you're trying to solve, right? And what mm-hmm. kind of solution you can provide. And that's what we've seen right now with COVID. It's just intensified, which I'm very, very happy about.
Yeah, and also, I mean, like you were saying, it kind of shines a spotlight on tech right now and how it can mm-hmm. kind of help society. And what's occurred to me is that in kind of quite recent years, if you have an idea, we have the tech that can actually make it happen, and quite quickly. You were mentioning hackathon as well, and I've heard quite a bit about this. Could you describe what it is, maybe to the listeners who aren't as aware?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually one of my favorite ever movements, because I strongly believe that hackathons and hacker days are not just events, they are the movement. I first ever came across it actually at Flixbus, because we were organizing every 3 months a hacker day. The point was that we were putting together the developers, product owners, and anyone from business as well who has ideas, kind of locking them, of course, not like literally locking them, but closing them in a big room and giving them everything they needed for about 2 or 3 days. And we'll let them go nuts with coding.
No way.
Completely nuts. They could code whatever they wanted. They could code, you know, they could go limitless. They could use any of the technology they want. Like whatever, as long as they have strong drivers, everything is possible. And we had also the business representatives there, the guys from marketing departments, for instance, sales or charter, and they were bringing their ideas. Oh, guys, can you make that happen? Can you do that? That if I press that button, you know, my customers will know about this. So there was no limit, project deadline, you know, budget, nothing. You just code. And that's when I became so incredibly obsessed with it, because I saw, you know, the shining eyes of developers when they were working forward for the hacker days. They're like, God, I won't have any limitations. I can code the shit out of it. and then in COVID-19 period, hackathons appeared. I mean, they existed before, but they just intensified. Again, it's like someone just you know, pressed and gave us an energy drink, and it just went much faster.
Yeah.
During COVID-19, I participated, I think, at least 5 or 6. I was mostly mentoring and coordinating. And the point there was, usually there is an organizer. I mean, I participated in the one, a global hack where UN was organizing it. Another was organized by European Commission. They give facility, they provide the platform, they provide communication tools. And they say, guys, brilliant minds from all over the world. These are our challenges, supply chain, healthcare, social isolation. Please provide the solutions. And developers come together, usually either on Slack or it can be any other tool that they prefer. And they get together. And I saw it's absolutely amazing how people self-organize when they have the purpose and the cause. They self-organize and they just, okay, I need a front-end developer. Here we go. Here I am. Where are you based? Oh, yeah, in Sofia. And I need a designer. Where are you based? Well, in London. And you usually receive around 3 or 4 days. You have to work on the solution. And then the teams have an opportunity to present, to pitch their ideas. And the coolest part about hackathons is that some of them actually transform into matchathons, which is the next level. When the winners, the ones whose speeches were actually selected by the committee, mm-hmm. they get to be partnered with potential corporate or public institutions or investors who could actually make these ideas, these MVPs, happen, mm-hmm. minimum viable products happen. I'm actually even a bigger fan of matchathons because there, I was working as a matchmaker myself. This is where you actually make these dreams come true. You see an MVP, you see a proposal, you see a web application, and then you can find or match this startup or this group, this team, with someone who can actually provide facility or resources or licenses. And that idea is actually starting to work and it's happening. And this is something absolutely amazing, really. It's like kind of global Silicon Valley in a way.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how it, what I've seen. But of course, I'm sure there are many more amazing movements, online movements mostly happening. But these were one of the most prominent so far.
I find tech moves really fast when there's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with COVID now and obviously technology being in the place where it is, you really notice the speed of how quickly stuff's being developed.
Absolutely, absolutely. I fully agree. You know, you very nicely put it. I think once it's like a very interesting recipe, right? If you put tech together with the purpose or with the cause,
mm-hmm.
It does not necessarily have to be, you know, safe children or something really, really massive like people, crises, genocides. I mean, tech supports there tremendously, but it can also be something quite small, right? Just help your own neighborhood or set up online chat groups for kids who cannot go to school, right, because of this whole isolation. Even like around your own community, it's absolutely amazing what tech can do. You just need the right problem statement, you need the right value proposition, and you can see the impact very, very quick. Yeah.
I think in the past, developers were almost the unsung heroes of technology in mm-hmm. like in society, but I think now nobody takes people involved in tech for granted anymore because we realize how important technology is in the world. I've been thinking about the career of a developer and mm-hmm. how you'd necessarily get into that industry because a lot of the people I've been speaking to who work in tech have said that they, when they recruit or hire, they look for someone who's involved in tech in their day-to-day life. So what advice would you give to developers that want to get into the industry?
Very good question. I think when you are already a developer, so you are coding, you have certain technology stack, or you not necessarily a developer, you are a tester, a quality assurance, a manager or a product owner. If you want to get into the industry, the first question that I would recommend to ask yourself, I mean, you will probably see throughout or you've seen already about me is that I'm a big fan of the right questions. You know, if you ask the right question, you can always get the right, you can get the correct answer afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's all about, there are no wrong answers, there are just only incorrect questions. But the first question that any techie should ask or developer should ask themselves is, what do you actually want? What do you actually want and need from tech? Because tech, again, you can leverage it. With tech, you can achieve, you can do something really bad because you can, I don't know, you can set up an unlawful and completely legal surveillance systems, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can, you can help your own community and you can help to support the system for irrigation in somewhere in Africa. So the first question is why? Your own personal why has to be very clear. What do I want? Do I just want to be a freelancer who hops from one place to the other, earns a lot of money, and just kind of benefiting from what I know, not really going or digging further? Do I want to be supporting, I don't know, foundations and actually coding something for the cause? Do I need just to constantly be learning and I don't really care what the cause is, right? So the why has to be very clear. The second thing, what I would also recommend, of course, is to consider the money aspect, because it depends. Like as a developer, of course, this is quite elite nowadays. If you're a techie, that usually comes with quite a good financial package. But again, if you're working for a bigger corporation, that's clear. If you're working with startups, that's a slightly different story. Mm-hmm. You won't exactly have a comfortable 9-to-5 life, job life. It will be, you really need to commit, which is the thought thing that you need to be also ask yourself. What level of commitment you'd like to have as a developer? Is it a vocation for you, or is it just the way to earn money, or... I think this is a question that anyone usually asks, regardless of whether you're in tech or not. And maybe the fourth criteria, the fourth point, which is quite important, and what I also learned, you need to be very clear what you're passionate about. And you can be passionate about money. You can be passionate about hobbies. You can be passionate about coding, data analytics, AI. But there has to be that passion because... this is one of the, I think this is the reason why tech has been experiencing such a boom lately, because it unites a crazy number of very passionate geeks who really want to, you know, change the world. I know it sounds pretty kind of, you know, too much in a way, but they do, because they see that with the help of a code, with the help of one line, they can provide great impact, and they really can bring a change. So this is also something that I recommend. I also recommend that as a hiring manager, because when I hire a developer, sometimes I watch out for it. There's always a question in my interviews, like, look, what do you actually want from life? You know, is that easy? What are you passionate about? And there is no wrong answer here. It's just either fitting or not fitting a certain culture in tech company you want to join.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And about tech culture as well, it has to be the right fit for you, because especially with technology, the culture can vary massively. You know, you're mentioning mm-hmm. tech startups and, you know, the tech giants, and those cultures are so far apart.
Absolutely.
I'm intrigued to find out your opinion on what's best to know about tech, in the way that, would you say it's best to have one piece of tech that you are like very knowledgeable in, or mm-hmm. would it be better to have a blanket knowledge of kind of all tech?
Very good question. Well, it depends what you want again. I'm coming back to the original why question, right? If you, it depends what kind of a layer or what you actually want to do with tech. If you want to dedicate your life to building, for instance, infrastructure, making sure that the systems works, and you're passionate about DevOps, you have to dig crazy in there. Mm-hmm. If you want to build a massive product, and want to like build applications and stuff, but you don't really want to be connected too much to code, but you need to understand what developers are talking about, right? Then maybe the product ownership would be quite interesting for you. Mm-hmm. So I think it all depends where your the passion lies. So these two questions, they come at the front once again: why and where your passion lies. There are roles in tech where you don't have to be a code Jedi for sure. Just need to understand basics, because, for instance, your team, when they have technical discussions, even if you don't code yourself, you need to be able to understand whether they bullshit you a little bit, yes. or and maybe you could be able to kind of support them and advise on certain things. For instance, that always helps in certain organizations when you're an engineering manager. You don't code yourself, but you do lead a team of engineers, and you simply won't get respect from them if you don't have no idea what they're talking about. In agile structures, it's different. You can be a people manager without understanding the code. But even then, you have to be having a very slight idea what your developers are talking about, or at least be curious about it. If you're not curious, and again, the community, the group, the team will not take you seriously because they'll say, okay, it's a paper pusher. Fair enough. She doesn't really care what we do, and we won't care what she says then. You know, we won't consider her feedback or his feedback. So it really depends which area, what you're passionate about, and why you want to do it. But definitely, if you want to be a developer and you want to contribute in a certain area of development, front end, back end, or DevOps, or design, your UX area, you have to dig deep and you have to constantly learn. You have to constantly educate yourself because the technology develops so fast, incredibly fast. And it's not like you're living from one Google I.O. to the next Google I.O. You have to be educating yourself your own way. And very often, it's not just about reading articles or participating in conferences. It's also a lot about self-learning, researching, experimenting. And that's what I meant by, you write a code, you work from 9 to 5, but that shouldn't stop you from actually sometimes spending your own time on researching and educating yourself and learning more about technology. Otherwise, you'll just get stuck in your own century. And by then, the technological century will go much faster forward.
And I think it's really important to, one of the best ways to learn about in kind of anything in any industry is the people mm-hmm. aspect.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
You know, getting involved with people. I mean, I think you learn more from people than you can from any kind of avenue, I guess.
Oh yeah. Like you now went into my favorite field, like people and communication. I won't shut up, really. But I'm actually a huge fan and a big propagator and if you wish, of people and conversations.
Absolutely.
That is something that you can learn from incredibly much. I know there are certain countries and certain cultures and certain companies who are incredibly obsessed with certifications, titles. You know, you have to write all your titles before, and also have to write like, oh, by the way, I also can ride a horse, so that's also important. but like it all is all very nice, what I learned, for instance, in my 10 years career, all in all, 90% of everything I know, I learned from people whom I worked with.
Absolutely.
I learned from my own experience and mistakes, and I learned from one conversation at a time, preferably honest and very open conversations. Mm-hmm. That's usually the best ever source of knowledge, sharing experience. It's something that cannot be really replaced by anything else. It's very hard, at least.
Yeah, that's so true. And also there's the other side of communicating with people. It's just, you never know what might come of it. It's like most business ideas in like the 70s and the 80s came out from having a conversation in the pub, you know. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Honestly.
Oh, you know how it all happened, right? The first ever chat, as we know, the legend says, it all started in a garage, right?
Oh so yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm going to change the topic a little bit here, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So I'm going to create a bit of a scenario. So imagine if I was an aspiring entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. How would it be best to attract talent?
I love it. Funnily enough, I was actually approached by a couple lately with that question. A guy came over and said, absolutely amazing, talented guy with flashing, you know, mind-breaking ideas. And he says, look, I can't keep people. You know, I go from hackathon to hackathon. People join on board with me and then they disappear in a couple of days. Like, why? What's going on? And yeah, that's a very good question. And then he came to me already with a clear request to fix the people side. He said, look, I probably suck at attracting people. I probably suck at motivating. You know, that's a problem. Or maybe there's something wrong with people nowadays, you know. I was like, let's step a little bit back. And what turned out in the end, after an hour of our conversation, I didn't say a word. I was just asking questions. It turns out that the guy didn't have a clear picture about the problem he was trying to solve and an actual solution.
Right, okay.
There were lots of passionate ideas. And they were really, I mean, trust me, like absolutely genius ideas. And the cause was absolutely amazing. Humanity level cause.
Right.
And it was so massive. And then imagine a UI UX designer comes on board, looks at it and says, man, what do you want? Like, what is actually you're trying to do here? And then the person keeps on going on a very high level. And then the designer, after a couple of days, will say, okay, well, I'm just probably not really dumb suit for it. You know, sorry, I'm just can't think that the fall. So what I learned working with actually when coaching startups and young entrepreneurs when they were going into that field, first thing that I always was recommending is think about the problem, the actual problem that you're trying to solve. It cannot be too big. Like, I want to fix the hunger in the world. That's nice, but you know, you have to narrow it down. Unless you're God itself, if you believe in one, it would be very hard to actually fix the hunger. You have to look into a certain period. The second thing that I always recommend them, be very clear about the solution you provide. Try to be very clear. What is the solution about? Try to visualize it. Try to actually, I know it's enormous to you. You are full of ideas and thoughts, but try to structure it. You have to provide a clear framework for the solution you have in mind. Try to be very clear about value proposition. What is so unique about your solution? And try to be very clear about the impact. Is it just, for instance, I don't know, this particular city? Is it the country? Is it a certain community that you're trying to affect? And in the last but not least, be very clear about your needs. What do you actually need? If you need a UI UX designer, where would you apply his or her talent? If you need a backend developer, okay, what would that be? What would be a technical stack? What would be the potential scope? When you have a very clear overview, the next step is usually, of course, is really when you're trying to attract people into your project, once that is clear, you already can filter people out a little bit. The second step is, of course, and that's what I'm a strong believer in, be very clear about, even if it's not yet a startup, if it's just an initiative or a project team, be very clear about the culture you're planning to build. Mm-hmm. Or the culture they are standing by. And a culture doesn't mean a huge one. You know, when we say culture, everyone has in mind right away, Apple culture, Google culture. You know, yeah. It took them years to build it.
Absolutely.
So really years, right? Decades. Here in your case, no, just basics. How are we going to be working together? How often are we going to be having meetings to sync? Should we work somewhere in an office, or should we kind of work from places, from our homes? What does matter for us? Does the process matter? Are we results driven? Et cetera, et cetera. So lots of things there. This is what actually builds the culture, the style of communication. And I think when you're trying to attract people to join you, try not to present this culture to them and say, okay, this is what I see, but invite them to shape it with you. That's amazing. It's so incredible. I mean, hardly ever would anyone would say no to this, because then people feel that they are contributing to creating something, and they're not just executing, but they are contributing and they are creating together with you. And you have a clear structure what you think would need to be created. Once there is a clarity, there is passion, there is a clear understanding that you're going to be doing it together, and you're very open as a young entrepreneur, open towards feedback, constructive feedback, you know, critique, then trust me, people will stand by you. And of course, something that never goes away, don't forget, right? It's all about the purpose and the why of every single person whom you are inviting. It might happen that you prepared all that and the person still said, no, it's not because of that. It's just the person's not interested in the cause you're trying to work for. But that's fine. You'll find someone who is.
You make it sound so simple.
Yeah, no, it's easy said than done. That's true. That's true.
So should we look at this from the other side then? So imagine I was a developer and I was looking to put a pitch together to an potential investor. I mean, what advice would you give me?
The good one. I would say first and foremost, as I mentioned, right? If you're trying to put a pitch together, it has to be very structured, very clear, sexy at the same time, and attractive for potential investors. Investors usually, they do care about the cost, but they also care about what's actually the price of a question, right? So first thing first, be very clear about, again, problem statement has to be super clear, because then it's already the first step. So many investors get filtered because they simply say, okay, it's not our area here. You know, there is nothing we stand by. When you're trying to solve the problem, for instance, and you're trying to attract the investors, the angel investors or venture capital, or even some investors from bigger corporations like Google, always try to kind of connect your problem and what you're trying to do with their values. That's very important, because this way they will feel that, you know, they're also sympathizing it, they are connected to it. And the second step after the problem statement, you have to be very, very, very clear about the actual solution. Either it's a demo of, like, I don't know, a couple of minutes, showing what the application is about or what the solution is about. So the more abstract you are, the more problem you are creating for yourself. You have to be very clear, very pragmatic, very down to earth, very structured. After the problem and the solution are already there, the next step, of course, is to show, okay, this is my selling point. This is what is so special about my solution. Now, there are so many solutions out there. There are so many talented people, entrepreneurs, getting born with so many ideas, but why you? Right? It's like kind of a interview in a way. I mean, why me? Right? Why should we hire you? Right? Why should we work with you? Why should we invest into you? And when that is clear, and you're also clear about the scope and the impact, you're showing exactly that you're not trying to save the whole world. Because if you tell investor that, investor will say good luck with that. That will be the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
And after that, of course, be super clear about what you need from the investor. That's like number one thing you have to think about. If you say, yeah, I'd like to have, you know, financial support and people, investor will be like, okay, great. What money are we talking about? Well, you know, the range between this and that. It's like, well, they say, okay, please do your homework and come back tomorrow. So you have to be very clear about the numbers, about the needs, about the resources, infrastructural resources, human resources, although I hate the word human resources, I would say people, right? People that you need, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to pretty much have a business plan in a way already written out. So that's, but in a very, very kind of a shorter version. You know, I also seen absolutely fantastic entrepreneurs whom I was coaching after hackathons. And I was like, can you show me your business canvas? It's pretty much one pager, which should describe all that I've just mentioned. And then they sent me a document of like 60 pages PDF, wow. You know, like in 11 font. I'm like, God, Jesus. I mean, if I were religious, I would say Jesus, Maria, Joseph, all of the family, you know, like what the heck is that?
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's so hurtful to I don't want to hurt their feelings either. I mean, they just spent like weeks working on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like very careful coming back like, yeah, that's wonderful, brilliant job. But we need to concise it to one page. It's like, what? Like, yeah. Yep. You need to create one pager, A5, A4, doesn't really matter. But it all has to be concise, structured, numbers, very clear state, problem statement, maximum one sentence, right? Value proposition, maximum two or three sentences. And you should see their faces. The first reaction is like, no bloody way. I'm like, oh, yeah. And it's just the beginning. It's just the first beginning for actual conversation. Trust me. And then the question comes, oh, but then what? This is whole business plan is not needed anymore. I'm like, yeah, oh yeah, it is needed. Because once you get the hook and investor is actually on it after the first one pager, then you're going to have to give this whole business plan and they will surgically take it apart for you. Because they'll tell you that's not okay, that's not okay. And then you'll have to slave on this document for the next couple of years. But that will already happen later. The first thing is always get investors on the hook with a very clear structure and showing them pretty much you know what you want. That's important.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And getting investors on the hook, you've got to remember that that is the absolute, it's the first step. So it has to be really distilled into exactly what it is in a very brief kind of way.
Absolutely.
And you're exactly right, get the hook. But then once they're on the hook, then you can progress it more from there.
Exactly. And one more thing is, what I also see a lot, don't be discouraged if that didn't work first time, second time, third time, because the relationship between a potential entrepreneur and an investor is like it's an actual relationship. It just doesn't click sometimes. You know, everything is there. The papers, everything is clear. Everything is completely, you know, the makeup is done, all the cosmetics, everything is brilliant and beautiful. And it just doesn't click. And that's okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I completely agree. In your opinion, I mean, from me looking from the outside in into the tech industry, it kind of seems quite saturated with developers, but there also seems to be a lot of opportunities. I mean, do you think it is saturated with developers and there's not enough opportunities, or do you think it's the other way around?
Well, depends on which context we're talking. I would say if you asked me that question 4-5 months ago, I would say, so many opportunities, not enough high quality developers, because it's also a lot about like there are lots of developers there, but it also depends on the needs of a particular process, a particular company, and really finding someone who is incredibly the technical expertise is very, very high and there is a culture fit. It's crazy difficult to find someone like that.
Yeah.
You either go for a perfect culture fit and then you need to give some time for a person to learn, or you go for great technical expertise, but then there's a serious problem of have been on the same ground.
Wow.
This at least has been this pony kind of, I've been like a pony going in circles for. I mean, as a hiring manager, I hired lots of developers. That's usually been my first ever problem. If you look at it now, I would say it equalized a little bit. Unfortunately, lots of startups, even very, 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 successful ones. Look at the Y card right now, what's going on, right? It's now, unfortunately, lots of incredibly talented developers are being laid off, or they've been asked to go, or they've been put on a shorter kind of time work where they can only work a certain percentage. And the talent out there is kind of now, it's actually a very disrupting environment. And it's not anymore that you are running after the developers. Now the situation is slightly changing. Developers might be running after you. So the field is leveling out a little bit. However, there are still companies which are benefiting from the whole COVID-19 situation. Online education, online platforms, movie platforms, etc. So I would say great tech talents will always find an opportunity. They will always find a company for themselves. But before it was really like headhunters really hunting, literally hunting developers.
Yeah.
Now it's changing a little bit. And I'm very curious to see, because the actual aftermath of that and the actual impact of that we'll see maybe in, I don't know, 3-4 months from now. It's too early to say. But I'm very curious how this level field will change. Employers on the one side, so to say, and techies on the other. And I'm having a feeling it will become much more flexible. It won't be purely about the money anymore. The culture and the purpose will become more important.
Yeah.
I see that already happening. So let's see how that goes. Yeah.
So you're mentioning cultures and kind of skill set there. So in your opinion, which do you think is more important when taking on a new employee? The cultural fit, or their qualifications to be able to do the job?
It is an incredibly difficult question. And I know that many, many managers or hiring managers who now would listen to me or developers will start throwing things at me mentally. But I'm a completely desperate fan of culture fit. I believe it deeply. And I was actually asked, one of the developers I work with, we had a conversation, and then in the end, he asked me, Anna, do you seriously believe into culture fit? Like, really? I'm like, oh, yeah, I do. And funnily enough, the question of that person was already the answer to me, whether the person fits in my team or he doesn't. The culture fit to me is incredibly important, because I strongly believe in the team and in people and their ability to self-organize, work together. Because if you, for instance, it just depends on the way you organize your team, you organize your department or company. If you expect them to be independent and organize themselves and really care about the product and the technical, the choices that they make, it's just technical skills are not enough there. What I usually do when I'm facing this dilemma, and I see that there's something still missing on the technical side, but I see the passion and will to learn, that I'll definitely go for that. Always on the scale, the culture fit, the passion, the willingness to, this natural curiosity and the fire in the eyes, not a crazy fire, but actually fire of curiosity is definitely something I will go for. This is what I also been preaching with my teams as well, because in agile environment, it's not just the hiring manager who makes a decision, but also the team together. It's a team hiring decision. And like I can tell you, in 8 years of my hiring experience, every time I was compromising and I was thinking, okay, maybe I should forget about culture right now. The girl is really awesome. You know, 15 years of technical experience. They're just going to come and rock our world. Well, in the end, yes, they did rock our world, not in a good way. this relationship was doomed, you know, yeah. And every time kind of fall on it, and then I say, shit, I pardon my French. Yeah. I knew it from the very beginning that it wouldn't really, and it didn't. And it doesn't mean, and the funny part about the culture fit and the purpose, and affiliation with this purpose, there is no wrong culture or wrong person fitting. Absolutely. It's just, it's a relationship. It either works or it doesn't. And if the person doesn't fit your culture, it definitely means that the person will fit someone else's. And you're actually doing a disservice occupying this person from finding his or her perfect place. And also doing disservice to yourself when you purely focusing on the technical skills and occupying a place which could be taken by someone who actually really wants to work at you, at your company. So that's why, yeah, I always go for culture fit, and everything else will come. I trust my team to teach that person to that the person becomes better at that. And trust me, 99.9% of cases a person does appreciate the trust we put and the power of a team and working together, and that person gets on the level that is needed.
It's so interesting. Do you find that you have to trust your instincts when taking on a new employee, when interviewing? Is that a skill that you've got better at over the years?
Yeah, good question. I would say yes and no. In Germany, there's a really cool phrase, words. They say "jein." It's a combination of "ja" and "nein."
Okay.
It's yes and no, because it is a gut feeling. I just, most of the time when I have that weird stomach feeling, that means either I ate something bad or there is actually not working with a potential candidate. But you know, yes, it is a gut feeling, and it is still based on the experience, right? It's not just you were born with this. It does come with experience. But at the same time, I still realize that after years and years of hiring, I either always have a temptation to compromise it and go for a quick and easy solution, which turns out to be long and difficult. I just keep learning. Sometimes that gut feeling, I'm going for culture fit, and then it turns out actually no, because there's a big danger when you constantly go for culture fit. Well, let's put it that way. There is a danger when you don't question your perception of culture fit. This is actually a very interesting phenomenon that I also noticed about myself. If you close yourself in this culture fit box too much, then you're not open to new ways of doing things. You stop being open to people coming and bringing something new to your culture. And that's actually super dangerous. I see many successful companies nowadays who are completely closed to any kind of alternatives. And this is also pretty dangerous. It becomes, you know, religious in a way. It's like fanatical within the company. That's very dangerous. So very often I notice that I'm falling into this as well. I'm like, But the answer to that question was not exactly what we would say. And then I try to ask myself, and why and what and what's the problem? It's a different answer. It doesn't mean it's a bad one. Maybe you should consider it. But the trick here, if you are starting to stretch a little bit those limits of a culture fit that has been more or less agreed in your team, you're also making yourself vulnerable. And you're open to risks because it either is going to shoot back into your face badly, blow it in your face, or it will actually bring something new to your culture and it will become richer. So that's a very thin ice there. You kind of, it's like you're dancing around. You never know what's going to shoot. Yeah.
And I've also been thinking about tech startups and the culture that they have. And then, so when a tech startup, if it becomes more and more successful and they take on more and more employees and they end up actually quite a big business, that culture has to become almost more corporate, would you say?
Yeah, exactly. If you're becoming bigger, if you're scaling up, you don't have to be becoming corporate. You don't need, as I mentioned, you don't need a second Google, you don't need a second Apple. But what you need to be ready for, you need to be ready to keep pastoring, growing, nurturing your culture, and it doesn't have to be corporate, but it can be unique to your particular company.
Absolutely. I think to wrap us up today, I mean, honestly, Anna, I could chat to you all day. This is so interesting to me. But I think to wrap us up, I think I know what the answer to this question might be. I'm pretty sure, actually. But in your opinion, what's the single most important aspect of a tech business?
I would say if I have to single it out, that will be people.
Yeah.
Because I've seen that people are defining tech. People are reinventing it when it's needed. People are finding the way to apply it. And people are creating the culture and the technical community, which I'm so fascinated by. And I think if we don't forget it, I mean, among all the new digital norms, numbers, budgets, ventures, investments, all that behind that is people. And going down to very small kind of a unit of it, if you're an engineering manager, you're a developer, the team that you create or being a part of is incredibly important to actually make sure that the tech is successful, because tech does not exist on its own unless we create Skynet, and then the Skynet will be telling us what to do. You never know how that's going to go. But it's definitely people.
Amazing. It's been absolutely amazing chatting to you today. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been definitely a pleasure. I really love, as I mentioned, I strongly believe in sharing stories, and I really hope that what I mentioned today was kind of flying thoughts and sharing those thoughts that I had in my mind. If that helps at least one person or someone find something interesting in it. So thanks a lot for that.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you've enjoyed it, feel free to give us a follow on SoundCloud, iTunes, or Spotify. See you next time.